Welcome to the Going Banana Show, Eugene Chaplin, son of the great Charlie Chaplin. How are you?
Fine, these strange days.
These are really strange days. How's life in Switzerland?
Look, it's the same as everywhere else, you know. We've been on semi-lockdown now, but the kids still go to school and life continues.
And how's Chaplin's World, the museum?
Look, it's closed down. It was closed down, and it will open up middle of December for over Christmas, because Christmas is a good time as well to be for Chaplin's World to be open, because it celebrates as well my when my dad died. You know, because he died on Christmas Day.
Very sadly. But what's the target target audience for Chaplin's World? Is it children wanting to learn, or but it must be so many older people that have so many great memories?
Well, you know, at first we thought it was going to be elderly people who remembered Chaplin, but the target is the families, because the main house is for people who know about Chaplin and can see how he lived there the past 25 years of his life. And then you have a second part, which is the studios, which is you discover his work. You actually go into his films and see some of the sets and stuff like that.
But you were born there, right? You lived in this house.
Yes, I was born there. I was the first one there and the first one and the last one out.
How's that when you entertain guests into there must be so many memories with your family, with your father, with your mother, all your sisters and brothers. Must be a bit weird now that it's I don't want to disrespect you, but you could maybe relate it to Graceland's from Elvis, you know, that that you grew up there.
Well, yeah, it's the family house. It is a bit strange, you know, but, well, you know, I'm used to it. And as well, the family wanted this to happen, so it's not too bad. I'll tell you what I think is very strange. Usually a museum is about dead people. And when you walk in that museum, I have pictures of myself there. So I feel that very weird.
Are all the family pictures still around the house still now?
Yeah, well, there's a whole wall there with all the family pictures where you see, you know, pictures of family life. And, it just proves to you that he lived there. And there's loads of family videos and stuff.
What I have to ask you, Eugene, what's it like when you're born and you grow up and you've got your father, who's just your father to you, but he's probably the most famous person on the planet. Certainly, through a long part of his career, he was the most famous person in the planet. I mean, could you move around? Could you go shopping? Could you do without being hounded by every single person that wanted an autograph or a picture or something like that?
Well, I think my father came to Switzerland because Switzerland is a very quiet country. The Swiss people are very shy, so they always keep a distance. They never dare go up to, you know, they dare go up to him. So for him, it was nice because after living in the States and all the troubles he had over there in the States, coming to Switzerland, at last he could have the normal life he wanted. And, you know, he used to walk down to town to buy his newspaper and stuff like that.
Mr. Chaplin, just going to buy a newspaper. Fantastic. But I mean, it must have been. But why? I thought about it because obviously I've read up about moving to Switzerland. Why Switzerland? Your father was born in London. And why Switzerland?
I think it's a question of just pure luck. He knew Switzerland from years before, he used to go to Semmeritz. And my mother was pregnant. She definitely didn't want to give birth in a hotel because, you know, he was in exile from America. So they drove around and someone said, look, there's a really nice house for sale. You should go and see it. And he did, visited it, and he loved it and decided to go there. But it's true, maybe, you know, he would have said maybe the south of France because it had more of the Californian kind of weather there, you know.
Was your father speaking French?
A few swear words, and that's about it.
It's the first language. I speak French, not as well as you. I speak French, but I think that might have been the first words I learned. But if you don't mind, I mean, I would love to talk because I think everyone has an interest in your father, and you can recount the story in its truth. But he started from my knowledge that he had quite a difficult upbringing. It was very poor in London. And but both of his parents were music hall performers.
Exactly. He was born in the East End of London, and his father, Charles Senior, was a music hall entertainer. He used to sing romantic songs about romantic little love songs and stuff like that. He was a big charmer. And his mother used to sing songs as well. And at the age of five, they divorced. Well, the father disappeared more or less because he had loads of girlfriends and hardly drank a lot. So anyhow, they broke up. So my father was very close to my mother, to his mother. And she had to fight very hard because she worked at night in the music hall, and during the day she worked as a seamstress or a dressmaker and doing little jobs like that, trying to make ends meet to make sure that food would come to the table. And the story goes that one night she was on stage, and my father was there in the wings playing around. He was about 6 years old. My mother started to sing a song, and then she had a kind of a tickle and a cough, and she couldn't get her breath back, so she couldn't continue the song. So my father saw her being in difficulty on stage, so he went on stage and finished the song. He was, I think, 7 years old. And people thought that was really cute. So they started to throw money at him. And he noticed more he was bowing, more money was being thrown at him. So what I like to say is maybe it was then he understood that was the kind of job he wanted to do.
Amazing. I mean, I obviously influenced from his parents. I read on the internet, I read one quote that your father said, I was hardly aware of a crisis because we lived in a continual crisis. And being a boy, I dismissed our troubles with gracious forgetfulness. Wonderful.
Yeah, exactly. You know, because afterwards, his mother had mental problems, mental health problems. And she had to be interned into one of those, you know, hospitals, psychiatry hospitals. So he was more or less left alone with his brother. And
he was very young.
Living on the street.
He was very young. He was only 14 or something, no?
Yes, exactly. He was living on the streets, basically, because he didn't want social services to take him away. And it's by seeing street performers at first, and then imitating people, you know, walking and doing, imitating people passing by and stuff like that. And then eventually found a job in a circus where he learned a lot about the art of clowning and being an acrobat and juggling. And at the end, his brother found him a job in the Fred Carnot Company, which was the biggest musical company in England at the time. It had two or three troupes. And he played different parts. He played in Sherlock Holmes. He played in, a drunkard, which he became very famous for. And the Carnot troupe left to tour America. And in the same troupe was Oliver Hardy.
I read that. And in a similar situation to your father at that time, not famous, no money, I guess.
Yes, I guess so, yeah. They were on the same boat going over to America. And then my father was spotted by Max Sennett very quickly. So my father decided to leave Fred Carnot. And I think Stan Laurel continued for a while before he turned to cinema afterwards.
Did they stay friends for forever?
They knew each other, but I wouldn't say they were great friends. They didn't hate each other. I think it's just that they were both occupied with their own things.
Right, but they both had exponential success.
Yes.
In a comedic form.
Oh, definitely. And let's say Laurel and Hardy was later than Chaplin. They became famous just before the talkies. And they managed to get into the talkies. You know, what is incredible about Laurel and Hardy is they dubbed their voices in different languages themselves. So when you see Laurel and Hardy in German, it's them speaking German. When you see Laurel and Hardy in Italian, it's them speaking Italian.
Wow, I didn't know.
They learned the text all phonetically.
Wow, really, really great. Where do you think that it was due to your grandparents or influence or possibly your father's upbringing of poverty and having to survive? Do you think that's what created the tramp, the character of the tramp?
There's a certain influence, I guess. But when he got his contract with Max Sennett, for weeks, he wasn't working. They didn't call him. And suddenly, in Kid Out of the Races, Max Sennett said, look, go and get yourself a costume. And come and we will start to film you. So he rushed and he looked for a costume. So he took baggy pants because baggy pants always looked funny. He put a jacket on and he said the idea of the mustache was to make him look older because he was very young then.
Yeah, I read that it was a little bit haphazard how the costumes and the. And I think I read that he said he had no idea of what he was going to do, but when he put the costume on, he fell into it, and it was just the character was born.
Yeah, so, you know, I think it's like clowning. It takes time to develop the character. You know, at first, if you look at his really early films, it's just pure slapstick. And as it goes on, the character has the tramp has more personality. that you become socially conscious. You know, there's all different steps.
Yeah, I read about that, and I saw some pictures of just completely. And you know, you think of today with all the social media, there was nothing like this, and it's amazing that news traveled around the world with his movies and the success. You know, I read to see how many followers on Instagram different famous artists are now. And they're in their tens of millions. And I thought, I wonder how many Charlie Chaplin would have if he had that success today. Completely astronomical.
Yeah, well, you know, the little tramp is so universal. The art of pantomime is so great because you don't need any language. And it's just pure emotion. So it gets to people. And, you know, okay, I know my dad was famous. You're asking me, did I know I had a famous dad when I was a kid? At first, not. And then, of course, at school, people saying, oh, you're Charlie Chaplin's son. So you're kind of aware of it. But I'm really taking conscience of it. It's now, because 130-odd years after him being born, I'm here on internet talking about him. And that's completely extraordinary.
And then, I mean, it was very quick that that Charlie Chaplin started actually directing and producing his own movies.
Well, yes, I think he just understood that doing only slapstick wasn't enough. You had to take it a step forward. So he started to direct, and then started to write his own stories.
I read that he's made 80 movies, but then he had a contract that he had to do a short movie. He had to do a different movie every week. And I wonder how much pressure, because, you know, here at Europa Park, I'm involved in with the shows, and we have deadlines and everything. And I can't imagine, with your father's success and expectation, how he dealt with the pressure of the deadline of a new show, which, you know, in show business and maybe in singing and in different entertainment, you're as good as your last movie, or you're maybe as good as your next one or your next performance. And I just wonder what was his character like to deal with this significant pressure? Because obviously there were a lot of money men, a lot of producers that were behind him, pushing him. And how could he have dealt with that creative process?
Well, you know, he understood very quickly that you're never better served than by your own person than yourself. And the minute he made enough money, which was very quickly, when he did these films with Max Sinnott, he decided to open up his own studios, and he built his own studios. And then he had his own team. He had his own team of actors. And that's how he managed to get the quality out, because he always worked with the same troupe.
Yeah, it's great when you have this team around you and you trust them and they know in which way you work. It's the same on a much significantly smaller level. It's the same as here in Europa Park, that we're putting our shows together, that when we rely on our sort of family team, who do their part, and everyone trusts each other, and much the same. But the international pressure for your father must have been significant.
Well, for him, you know, he used to work. He would have a storyline. He would know this, what story he would want to tell, but all the gags were invented with his troupe by rehearsing and trying things out. That's why in some of these films, you see there's so many takes. because he tries out one thing and then he realizes that it's not getting there or it's not funny. So he changes the scenery and tries something else.
I guess it wasn't easy working for your father because he was internationally known as quite a perfectionist now.
Well, he was a perfectionist. When you worked with my father, if you were an actor, you had no improv to do. He would tell you exactly what you had to do. He knew every part, every woman's part, and he would explain. So, of course, what I say is he was a tyrant. Well, let's say if the end product is good, he's a genius. If the end product is bad, he's a tyrant.
But it's on him.
But it's, yeah.
Yeah, but when you say about the money, I read somewhere that, which is still significant today, that he was earning $670,000 a year when he was 20, 24 years old.
That's right, yeah.
Amazing. I mean, how did he deal? How did he keep his feet on the ground, having that immense wealth, but the pressure to keep creating?
He never, ever forgot where he came from. So, he would even tell us, I remember the number of times he would say, look, you're so lucky to go to school. And I'd look at him and say, yeah, sure. He says, yes, you're so lucky. Now, I would have loved to go to school when I was your age. Now I know what he means.
Well, I mean, it's true. Rags to riches story, no? Which in many of his movies, he portrayed this very poor character. Just amazing creative mind. But by writing the music, writing the story, producing it, acting it, and basically acting for everybody else. Now, it's a tremendous, tremendous achievement.
Well, he knew exactly in his head what he wanted, and it was the only way he could do it. But what I like to say as well about the Little Tramp, the success of the Little Tramp, and I say basically, the Little Tramp is you, it's me. Everyone has a little bit of the Little Tramp in them. So when you see a Chaplin film, you recognize yourself in it.
Hmm. But then I also, with some other notable stars, Douglas Fairbanks, and he started the United Artists, which is still going today. Where I think we've just passed the 100-year anniversary of the company, no?
Exactly. Well, it's a natural continuation of his theory. He wrote, he composed his music, he had his own studios, and he didn't want to be under the thumb of distributors who would say, your film is too long or not long enough or whatever critic they had to do. So he founded United Artists with Douglas Fairbanks and Fairbanks' wife, and W.D. Griffith.
But great, it must have been difficult to do in those days. I mean, it's difficult to do now, but in those days, it must have been quite a challenge to do because a lot of people wanted him to have done that, right? Because they lose their star. They lose their big money.
It's true. No, it's true. Most people were signed up under a company, and like Laurel and Hardy, and they never got paid. And look at Buster Keaton. He lost all these films and everything. He didn't own anything. So my father knew how important it was. He knew how important it was when he composed music to have it protected.
Yeah, fantastic. I think actually I did an ice show in London last year in Hyde Park. And I wanted to use this piece of music that I'd used, and we made a comedic video, and I wanted to use Smile, and I think we might have paid you some money for that on the rights.
I'm sure.
No, but fantastic. I was so happy to have done it, really, because the music is so emotional. It told the story that I wanted to tell. It can be interpreted in different ways. And it was, I mean, some of the music your father wrote was very, very clever and totally emotional.
Well, you know, he was the first person who understood the importance of music with film. You know, before you had a pianist who would just kind of improvise, and he hated it because he thought it took the comedy away or the emotions away, distracted the emotions away. So, you know, he started to write music, and composers first, when they looked at at Chaplin's music, they're saying, you know, this is ridiculous because it's not logical. You know, it goes from one rhythm to another. You know, it's not professional. But once you see the music with the picture, he was composing his music to the picture he was looking at.
Yeah, beautiful.
So it suddenly made sense. It's an obvious thing now, but at the time it wasn't.
Was he? Could he play? What instruments could he play?
Like, he couldn't read music, but he could play piano. He played the violin and accordion.
Right. So he could give the. He worked with the writers.
Well, he. I remember him composing for his early films, because all the music of his early films were composed later. And my mother was at the projector, and we had the film in 16 millimeter because there was no video at the time. And my mother would switch on the film, like, let's say, let's take The Circus. She'd start the film, The Circus, and he'd start playing. Okay, he had a kind of idea what he was wanting, but he wasn't sure. Then he'd tell my mother, stop, rewind back. So he had to rewind the film back and get that scene again. And he would start rewriting. And eventually, once he got the melody right, he would have an arranger next to him. The arranger was called Eric James. And Eric James would mark down the notes.
And then during the whole way, your father got married a few times.
Yeah. No, you know, a lot of people have a lot of comments about that. But I think what you have to remember is that all the people in the show business in Hollywood at the time were very young. So you obviously had a lot of girlfriends.
Well, and he's the most successful artist in all the studios.
Yes. Well, you know, I think everywhere you go, it's the same. No, he got married four times. The first times, well, I guess the three first marriages didn't work because there were actresses. And it's me guessing, because he never said anything to me, but I'm guessing there are actresses. And when you're doing great films and all, the actresses want to be in your film. And suddenly he would look at someone else saying, no, this other person will be better for it. And I don't think that would go down very well.
Right.
So
he didn't really talk to you about those... His previous wives?
No, not at all. You know, for him, the past was the past, and he never talked about the past.
I from what I read, that your mother, with your father marrying, it seems like one of the greatest love stories ever. That he obviously met the perfect soulmate, true partner for him, no?
Yes, well, he met my mother by pure chance. She's the daughter of Eugene O'Neill, you know, the playwright. And
Nobel Prize winner.
Nobel Prize winner, yep. And she was beautiful. She was absolutely beautiful. And it just clicked. And she didn't want, well, before meeting him, she wanted to act. Then she gave up acting because she was happy with my father. And, you know, she was a real sunshine. She was full of warmth. She was very pretty, and most of all, very intelligent.
I also read about your father saying, "As I live with Una, the depth and beauty of her character are a continual revelation to me." It just sounds much deeper than he was very emotional about how your mother always amazed him.
Yeah, well, you know, the story I tell is my dad's life is in three parts. The first part is him being a young boy trying to survive, really just surviving. Then the second part is America, and it's focusing on his career, working very hard, and obviously getting the success. And the third part is meeting my mother. And what is extraordinary is the man who was so focused, who knew what he wanted exactly, and was so difficult and hard on himself, when he met my mother, suddenly he changed completely, and he couldn't do anything without her. So when he wrote his autobiography, she read it, and she was giving her advice what to change, or, you know, what.
Great
partnership. Just gave her opinion about things.
Great partnership.
She should give her opinion about the music he wrote.
I'm wondering why
she helped him.
I'm sorry. I wonder. There's quite a lot of controversy about your father. About the FBI seem to have. They seem to, accusing him of being a communist sympathizer, and it seemed like the FBI wanted to bring him down. No, it's. By extraditing or not extraditing him. They've just refused his visa. Is that right?
Well, you know, what happened is, by the way, it's the 80 years of the Great Dictator. The reason why I'm saying that is when my father wanted to do in 1938 the Great Dictator, he got death menaces, and the American government really lay into him, trying to stop him from making such a film. And he financed it himself and made it. I'm saying that's why that was part of the problem. The other problem was there was a young girl, I'm trying to remember her name, but it'll come back to me, who went to the papers and said she was pregnant, and the father of her child was my father. So all the Catholic organizations and the ultra-right start to say, oh, that chaplain had reputation and everything like that. And he did a paternity test, which was proved that the child wasn't his. But he was still condemned to pay a pension to that child that was 18.
I didn't understand that. Have you ever had an understanding of that? Why?
I was told that paternity tests weren't weren't accepted in the court at the time.
So, and so he paid for the child until 18?
Yeah. And then the third thing was he always defended the... He hated injustice. And during the McCarthy period, you know, if you're... if people thought you were a communist, you lose your job, you get sacked from wherever, and you couldn't work again. And people would be left starving with their families just because they were communists or communist sympathizers, I should say. So my father, out of provocation as well, said, you know, I'm interested in new ideas. So yes, I'm interested in communism. And he said, we shouldn't forget that the Russians held the front line and lost a lot of people. And if we are in a free world now, it's partly thanks to them as well.
Right.
And he said, you know, if you want me to come and explain myself in front of the Anti-Communist Commission, please, I'll come and explain myself. But they never did. They never did invite him. So another factor as well is Hoover, the head of the FBI, knew how powerful Hollywood was in propaganda. And he gave out instructions to the major studios in Hollywood what kind of films should be there and how good, you know, what they should talk about, and use them as propaganda films. And my father refused to do that. He says, I'll do the films I want to do, and no one's going to tell me. So the mixture of all that is when he left America to go to Europe to promote Limelight. He received a telegram saying that if he wanted to go back into the country, he would have to reapply for a visa, and we'll see if it will be considered or not. So he said, after all what I've done for America, they're going to treat me like that, and I'm not going back. So
he must have felt quite betrayed, no?
Oh, totally betrayed. Totally betrayed, and he was very, very hurt about it. And he didn't talk about it much, but, you know, in Switzerland, he would go down every day to buy the Herald Tribune just to keep in touch with what was happening in America.
But, and then he didn't...
It's only when he went back...
For the Oscar.
70s, for the Oscar, that... But he didn't want to go back. But my mother pushed him. And he did go, and I think it was the best thing which happened to him, because it put his heart at peace.
Very emotional. I saw the video of your father walking onto stage, 20-minute standing ovation. Very emotional, really, because it was. I don't want to say it was like an apology, but it was like an acceptance of you're a great creator. You are one of the most influential people in our business. It somehow it came over to me as everyone was just saying we love you for your years of creative work.
Yeah, well, it was recognition from the film industry, you know, one of the biggest film industry in the world, which was Hollywood, and he was totally shocked by it.
Yeah, it was very emotional.
In a way, he was very touched by it.
And your mother was there with him, right?
Yeah, she wasn't even supposed to be there. And my father didn't want to go on stage, you know. He says, I'm not going, son of a bitches, and whatever. And my mother convinced him, said, look, go on stage and I'll come after.
How did he, because there's, Did he talk like that, where you say, oh yeah, son of a bitch? Would he talk with lots of passion and use these words? Because in the artistic world, I have to say, whether it's right or wrong, it still is used that people express emotion. I am actually a lover of that. I like when I've had artists or something sort of losing it sometimes. I never really scold them, because I actually embrace them showing their character, because I think we learn more about the person. They feel eventually more comfortable about being a great artist. What makes them a great artist is their sort of extrovert character. And some people keep it reserved. But was your father very extrovert when he was talking with you, or was he reserved as a father?
He wasn't an extrovert, but if he saw something he didn't like, he would let us know.
Yeah, he was quite a strict father. No, very very strict on getting you all a great education and preparing yourself for the life. No,
well, he was strict on discipline, and he had his morals. You know, we weren't allowed to play with water guns inside the grounds. We weren't. He had full of things like that. He never had a German car. He always bought Italian cars or English cars and stuff like that. It's that because of the last World War. He was full of principles, but he knew that if a child is well educated, just by his manners, by saying please and thank you, that you'll have a better chance in the world, because people will like him.
Absolutely. And now you can go to many countries in the world and there's a statue of your father, even though that he's British or he's English. He's worked in America, but there's so many statues of your father around the world. They all claim a part of Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah, well, everywhere they do now. I would say most of the world will think that he's American, because obviously he made his fortune there in America.
Yeah.
But he stayed very British. You know, even his studios had a kind of countryside cottage look.
Yeah. English countryside. Do you spend much time in England yourself?
Yeah. Well, I have my son there and stuff. I go quite a bit.
But I noticed that that even now, after all the history of movies, that some of your father's movies are still regarded as masterpiece, the best of all time.
Well, you know, I believe that. In every media, before it was books, then it was theaters, you had always people like Shakespeare and Molière and all, who knew how to bring out the eternal problems, which are never solved. And Chaplin did that in his films. And he, you know, the impossible love, the difference between rich and poor, and it's that, and it hasn't changed. You look at Modern Times, the film Modern Times, you know, you're talking about machine over man. Well, you know, we're getting there now.
Because I've had some experience with working with intellectual properties of doing shows, and I have to work with the IP holder. Who controls the Charlie Chaplin rights brand now?
We do.
And who? All of you.
Basically, we have an office. We have an office in Paris. What we did is we leased the films out to a distributor, because this distributing the films is a work of its own. So MK2 does that for us. But if not, all the copywriting of music, the copywriting where the copywriting of the image, we look after ourselves.
And how many, is it all you and your brothers and sisters, or do you, is it into the children, and how many people are on the board of that then?
There's eight of us, and we have an office which has guidelines, so we don't interfere all the time. But if there's a major demand, then we get an email and we vote.
I just wondered, has anyone approached you to do a VR or an AR Charlie Chaplin content movie or presentation?
What do you mean by VR and AR? I'm sorry.
because here at Europa Park, that we've just opened a You'll Be concept, which is a VR concept. People will come in, they'll put the headset on. They've got sensors on their hands and their feet, and they turn into an animated character, and they have to do a challenge, and they go through a fantastic experience, shared experience with different people. And I just wondered, has anyone ever approached you, or with the augmented reality, whether someone said, hey, we can put Charlie back on stage for you?
Well, yes, we were approached once or twice, but we did. The majority of us thought it wasn't a good idea. I think we have to see when that technology gets really good.
Do you have fights amongst your family about that? Because somebody will come up with an idea, it's such a recognizable theme. But
we do. Well, I think we all mean well, but you know, we all have our own vision of our parents. So, as an example, if a cigarette make says, can we use Charlie Chaplin to promote cigarettes, a make of cigarettes? There'll be some of us will say no, because he was against, he always said he didn't want to promote cigarettes or alcohol. But then some of us will say yes, but I remember in the early days he was smoking. So, you know, and you have the debate, and the majority wins.
And the majority wins, yeah? So there's eight of you, so five to three, and it's a go.
Yeah.
Cool. I also heard about that a few months, 3 months after your father died, somebody stole his coffin.
That's right, yeah. Not long after his death, the police phoned up and said, oh, someone dug up the grave and stole the coffin.
Unbelievable.
It was during the period in Italy, you know, you had Aldo Moro, who was kidnapped. Mm. And eventually, he was the bosses of the bosses in Italy. He was kidnapped and killed. So it was during the Red Brigade times as well. So you didn't know who we were dealing with. And my mother always said, look, we're not going to pay any ransom for a dead body. It's ridiculous. It went on. People came. First, we had to identify the people because we got, it's what I thought was shocking, is there was a lot of people phoning saying, oh, we want so much, and we'll give the body back. When you say, prove us that you have the body, right, they didn't. You know, there are people trying to cash on it.
Right.
But eventually, we got photos of it and just before they buried it elsewhere.
Was that a traumatic affair? It must have been a traumatic affair.
About 6 months. Yeah, well, especially for my mother, because some people were threatening the kids. You'd say, you know, your kids go to school, we're going to get them there and stuff. So for a while, the police had secret police guarding the schools and making sure everything was okay. So that wasn't nice. But when you see the end of it, it was just two poor guys basically trying to make a buck, and were inspired by Maria Callas, because someone stole the body of Maria Callas at the time. And that's how they got the idea.
So they went to jail, these two guys?
So they ended up in jail, yep. Oh, one, no, because he had less to do, but the brains behind it, yeah.
Huh. But when you're... When your father was back in Switzerland, he was still creating, still working. And I just wondered, with you running around as a child, you're growing older, what was he like when you were a child and he wanted to create something? There's so many different reactions from creators. Some, you know, they look at a blank piece of paper, you don't know what to put on it, and they get moody and shut me in a room or something. How was your father creating while you were a child growing up?
Well, he was very disciplined. And he had his times, to work, and then times, and then gave him free times as well. But basically, his routine was... around 8 o'clock, he would have his breakfast with my mom. And by 9 o'clock, he would lock himself in the library. Well, not lock himself, all doors closed in the library. And he would do whatever he was doing then. And then at 11:45, he would come out, have his lunch. Around 1 o'clock, go back, continue what he was doing. 5.
Mm.
And that's it.
And the kids don't go in the room while your dad's working.
Well, basically we were at school at the time, so it was during school time, so the house was pretty quiet. And during holidays, then we had to make sure not to make too much noise in the house.
Right. Well, it's beautiful, beautiful home now. The gardens are fantastic.
No, it's a great place. It's a great family place. You need a big family for that
place. I'm definitely coming to visit that place. As soon as the COVID situation becomes easier, I'm definitely coming to visit. It looks absolutely wonderful what you've created.
Well, you know, the biggest compliment I got was I was in Lausanne, the local town here, and someone recognized me and said, "Oh, Mr. Chaplin, I want you to meet the biggest Chaplin fan you'll ever meet in your life." I said, "Okay." And they showed me this little boy who was about 6 years old. So I said, "You really like him?" And the kid said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, then, once you should go to Chaplin's World and see the place." And he says, "I became a fan because I wanted Chaplin's World."
Yeah.
So, you know, that's exactly what we wanted.
Yeah, great. So you get a lot of school visits and stuff like that now?
Yeah, well, it's mainly families, you know. It's like the circus, you know. I say circus is family entertainment. The traditional circus, anyhow. And the kids love the animals, the kids love the clowns. Whatever, the older people will like the acrobats, contortion, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah,
it's a good family.
I heard that you had a lot of the circus, a lot of the Swiss circuses, Knock and Knie, they would come around and visit your father and bring artists around.
Well, every year Knie came to town, and we would go out. It was always a big happening. The whole family would go out, and the staff of the house was invited, and we would go and see the Saturday evening show there. And then after the show, he invited all the artists back at the house for a drink.
Very cool. Great for you. Great. How old were you? How old were you in those days?
Look, as young as I remember. You know, I was a very I was a very shy boy. And to me, going to the circus, I was always amazed to see all the different acts. And actually meeting the people afterwards and realizing that they're not superhumans. They're really just down-to-earth people was a great lesson.
But you had a lot of,
that's why I love you had a lot
of,
so much.
But a lot of famous, very famous people at your house visiting, no?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, you know, our next door neighbor was James Mason. We had Noel Coward who lived not too far. In Montpellier, you had Charles Lindbergh. There was quite a lot of people who lived around.
You've lived an extraordinary, extraordinary upbringing with these mega famous people. Just coming round for a coffee, or a cup of tea, rather.
Yeah, you know, some people. There's a famous Swiss French actor called Michel Simon, who played in the film Vieil Homme et l'Enfant, different films. The doorbell rang and he was there, and he says, "I'm here to see Charlot." He says, I'm not invited, but I'm just passing by to say hello." And my father came down and greeted him. He stayed at the house, you know, he stayed an hour at the house and left again. We had surprises like that.
Great, really. Well, one thing, going.
Oleg Popov,
yeah,
told me that he was in Venice with his show. And he read in the paper that my father was in Venice too, in whatever hotel it was. So he went to that hotel and he said, I want to see if Mr. Chaplin could see me. The concierge of the hotel said, "I doubt it." And he insisted a bit. So the concierge phoned up and my father said, "Who is it?" And he said, "It's Oleg Popov. He's a Russian clown." So my father said, "Oh, if he's a clown, I'll come down." And that's how they met.
Wow, wonderful. Sadly, Oleg Popov's no longer with us. He worked with us, about 7 or 8 years ago. He worked with us. Lovely. Fantastic.
Yeah, well, I was very honored to be in the audience when he came back to Russia in Sochi.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful man. Also a great, great accomplishments throughout the world.
Yeah, no, he's sweet. You know, I met him years back. I invited him to a comedy film festival in Switzerland. And it was still during the communist days. And I'll ask Popov if he wants to be part of the jury. And he accepted. And I went to pick him up in Zurich. And he was delayed because they couldn't find his luggage. And he came out and he said to me, well, I had a translator with me because I don't speak German. I'm just speaking in German. He said, my suitcases haven't arrived. They've kept my suitcases. But it doesn't matter because they don't have my soul.
But is this with all the people coming round and your father's connections, is this what brought you into supporting circus so significantly as you've been doing?
Well, yes. Well, you know, I'm from the theater. My real job is I'm a stage manager. And I stage managed for a while, then I went off to becoming a recording engineer and stuff like that. And then there was a festival, a circus festival in Lausanne here in Switzerland, where every circus in Switzerland was there. And I got a phone call and someone said, "Do you want to be part of the jury?" And says, "We're missing one person." So I don't know. They must have looked up in the phone book and said, "Oh, well, let's ask him." So I went there And next to me was this lady in a big fur coat, dark glasses, and smoking a cigarette, and looked like a real tough cookie, you know. And I thought, oh dear, how am I going to get along with her? And it was Mrs. Nock.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized she had a great sense of humor, and we became friends. And not long after that, she phoned me and she said, look, our artistic director has left our circus. Do you know of anyone? And I said, yeah, sure, me. She said, do you really want to? I said, yeah. So that's how it all began.
How many years did you direct with Nock?
8 years.
You directed the show and then you sent it on its tour, or did you tour with it?
I toured with them, then I would do the promotion.
Mm. Tremendous. But Circus Nock was very successful in those days, no?
Yeah, no, it was good. You know, it was the second biggest circus in Switzerland. It was certainly the oldest circus in Switzerland. But I liked it because it had very nice family values. It was very good, and their shows were good.
Yeah, very, very sad it's no longer touring.
I know.
Yeah, the circus is not, it's in a difficult situation, but you also did a festival in Canada, no?
Yeah, well, what happened is a town in Canada did a small circus festival there and asked me if I wanted to go over and see it. I said, okay. And it was held in a skating rink.
Ah, my world.
And it was with three rings, you know. And at the end of the festival, I just said to them, look, if you want me to comment on what is good and what is bad, since I have a little bit of experience, I can help you. And they said, okay, they were open to it. So the next year I got more involved with it, and eventually we got a tent, and it worked really well until, it's always the same problem, you know, that you're famous abroad, the festival did really well abroad, but unfortunately the local authorities didn't think so they stopped financing it.
I thought for the first few years it was the Eugene Chaplin tent, no?
That's right, yeah.
It was very successful in the beginning, I read.
Yeah, no, we had the best, really very nice shows. It was very big. Can you imagine you had an orchestra of 22-piece orchestra?
You blew the budget on that.
No, not at all, totally free. It was a local band.
Oh, great, great. But is this what...
The idea was... Yeah, the idea was as well to have good artists, but it's to get the young people involved as well.
But there's quite a lot. Your sister has her own circus in France, no?
My sister has a show called the Cirque Invisible. My sister, I think, was the first one with her husband to do taking circus things and put them on stage in a context.
I watched a couple of videos of something like that, and I thought, when I was watching it, I thought it was taking the talent, recreating it on a stage, and I thought a little bit, without the budget of Cirque du Soleil, it was along those lines, really. I thought that they're trying to recreate, because this is what Cirque have done. Cirque du Soleil took the talent, and then they recreated it basically on a stage. I know they've toured a lot in tents, obviously, but they're fixed buildings in America. Okay, it's exponential budget, but I thought something a little bit like that. Your sister's show with her husband that had that same concept. No, taking the talent and recreating a show, incorporating their talent.
Yeah, so they're just basically it's the two of them, you know. He does magic. He's a total eccentric magician, and my sister does typro, does trapeze, and a lot of transformation. And they do a whole show like that. It's like a dream. You come in, you have a certain kind of music, you sit down, and but it's like circus, but more intimate.
And you don't get involved in that show. You don't offer your.
Well, she calls me up sometimes and says, "Look, we're looking for such and such a thing. Do you know where we can get it? If I have any ideas, I help her out in that way."
What?
But
where do you think we are in circus right now? I mean, we spoke about Knock, very famous French circus, Pinder, Skylight, yeah. Cirque du Soleil, all having terrible problems. Cirque, certainly, we heard that that they're bankrupt. I mean, maybe it's gone into chapter 11, the protection of bankruptcy. But where do you think we are with circus? What hopes do you have?
Look, I don't think it's the end of it. I think it will always exist. Definitely, I think it will come back. Of course, it's difficult now because all the old ones or a lot of the circuits have terrible financial difficulties because then there's no way they can make money because the audiences are not allowed. But once the audiences will be allowed again, I think people will come back. I like to think, under what form, you know, it'll be different forms. It'll have to reinvent itself.
Absolutely, it has to recreate itself.
Yeah, well, you know, you have like the problems with the animals now and stuff like that. But I think, you know, the fact of going under the tent, having sawdust and having a band playing and have good artists and all that will always work. Because you can't get that anywhere else.
No, fantastic. Like you say, the sawdust. I was going to say the smell of the animals and the elephants and everything was beautiful.
Of course, are you
did you support or not support animals in circus?
Oh, I supported it completely. I think I think the problem of the animals in circus is taking the wrong way around. I understand what the people are trying to say, but I think they should fight more. You know, I think countries like India have to do more to extend spaces for their elephants and for their tigers. I think Africa too, you know. It's not the few animals which are in circuses now which will change the problem.
But you have quite an influence on the circus world. You're in a normal year. How many circuses or a lot of circus festivals? That's how we first met. And we were both on the jury in the Moscow exactly. The Moscow circus. Had way too many drinks in the hotel after. I think we stayed up till four or something.
A killer.
Yeah, but you have a lot of influence. But where do you think the problems are? Because I don't have any experience with circuses in India or where do you think we can help it?
But basically by going to it, you know, there's no, I think the people have to come, but no, we're living a world where there's a world of entertainment, where there's so much, there's films, there's television, there's just so much happening.
Streaming.
Theater, music festivals.
Yeah.
And I it's like when television came out, they were saying, oh, that's the end of cinemas. Well, it's not true. TV lived alongside films. I think people are saying now this is the end of circus. But I think what a circus person said to me, and I think it's so true, you know, we're talking about traditional circus and modern circus. And I think there's no traditional circus. I think the circus has to be original. And that's part of the artist's problem.
How do you feel when you're on the jury an artist comes out dressed as Charlie Chaplin? How do you feel about that? You must have many occasions where you see an artist take the hat, take the baggy pants, take the cane, and use some of your father's music. How do you? Because it's, you know, it's like, that's my dad. You know, how do you feel? Pride, or do you think it's not doing my father's name legacy justice? How?
Like it's doing my father. It does justice to my father, of course, but I'll never compare him to my father. No, I always say there's only one Chaplin.
Yeah. That's for sure.
One little tramp. But I don't mind if a circus artist uses a little tramp and adds something to it. It's great.
You have to come back you have to come when the COVID restrictions, I would very much appreciate that you come to us, see all of our shows here.
What I like about the theme parks is their shows. And I think it's nice having different areas with different shows. And, you know, they last, I like the format of 20, 30 minutes. And that's it.
Yeah. No, I like it like that. I've seen some, I've met with some owners or directors of different amusement parks, and their philosophy is not the shows and entertainment, but the big roller coasters. We are super lucky here that the Mac family love it. And I know it's freely given, so there's a significant cost involved, but it's, I always remember this one CEO of this park, which I won't say, and he said, I don't see the financial reimbursement. I don't see for the shows. And I said, well, it's in the satisfaction of our guest. That's important. That's why the people, we have many guests that only come to see the shows. That, of course, the core business is, well, it's the theming, it's the gardening, it's the family, it's the experience you have. But certainly, we have a lot of followers just following our artists, following our shows. Every year we're changing, updating. And I'm lucky for that, to be working here.
You know, the I think the roller coaster rides and all that is fine when you're young. But if I go on them, my stomach will turn upside down, so I prefer the shows anyhow.
Yeah, we've got some rides.
It's good that you cater for both.
We've got some rides that you'll appreciate the story, that you will love. But it'll be my pleasure to invite you next time.
But I would like to say I met with Roland several times. And I must say, he's done a lot for the circus. You can see he has that love for the circus.
Personally, my personal opinion is that Roland Mack would have succeeded whatever avenue he chose. But I think one of his decisions could have been circus. He's a very firm advocate of circus. Friends with a lot of circuit, different circuses in both in Germany, in Switzerland, in France, and I think he was recognized. He was on the jury of the Monte Carlo Circus Festival. And I think that was in somehow recognition of his commitment to circus. Obviously the Mack rides that we have, we used to make the wagons for circus. So I think Roland has a very, very fond memories of his experience with circus people.
And the circus people are very grateful to him because most of the artists have been working in Europa Park, you know, Hoosh Mahoosh and all that. You know, every year, the last show, you know, or the last week of the tour of the Knox was in Museum. And there was a big gala for, I forget his name, you know, the circus priest guy.
Father Heller.
Father Heller. Yeah, for Father Heller. And every year it was held in under the tent, the Knock tent. And they used the Knock show and they mixed it with the Europa Park artists as well. And it was absolutely marvelous.
Yeah, he was a super support to all the circuses. Big support to Europa Park, very, very close with Roland Mack. And
that's right, yeah.
We were lucky that he was always with us. And every time I go to a circus festival or something, somehow Farah Heller comes walking around the tribune and just, he's there. Big support, loves it. And yeah, you feel really good when he's there. He's a showman himself, you know. Of course, he is. Absolutely gets his, plays all the music, or I think he always plays When the Saints Go Marching In, is it?
Yeah, well, I went, I won't give the name, but one of the circus's bosses died a few years ago. He was the priest doing the funeral. And he was going on about, you know, he had this life, he had that life, and whatever. And suddenly, he picks up his clarinet and he starts playing a piece of music.
That's.
And after puts his clarinet down, he said, "Oh, let's continue." Jesus said.
Yeah, no, great. great showman. Not your traditional Farah, but embraces everybody and embraces this sort of artistic world, which is sort of sometimes in some way controversial, because we embrace people's creative controversies on stage even. And he supports it all. So it's really, really pleasure to know him. And
he was amazing with all the contacts and all. You know, I have a friend who is an artist. He's French. And I made him play at the Knox on the last show. Because the idea behind it, I said, maybe I can please the Knox and can get a contract for the next season. And Father Heller was there. And Father Heller loved them so much that he got so many gigs after that. It was amazing.
Yeah. No, we're very lucky to be in a great industry where we get to meet some wonderful people with big hearts, that's the creative mind now, that we are maybe a little bit over the top sometimes. Maybe we show great emotions, but I think we're all fortunate to be in such a great industry.
Yeah, I personally think that people want to be entertained. They don't want to think. They want to forget about everyday problems. They just want to have a nice evening. And these shows, you know, do that.
Yeah, no, brilliant. Eugene, honestly, it's been the greatest pleasure for me to listen to you. You've got such yourself have got such an interesting life. I think maybe we've covered 2% of it, maybe. And we've covered, spoken about your father, which is truly one of the all-time greats and will be remembered forever. And I want to really, truly, sincerely thank you for coming on this show, sharing your insights, sharing your committed support to the industry. And next time I would be very happy to invite you to Europa Park and we can have a nice dinner and enjoy the experience of the whole resort.
I'd love to. Look, the moment it's open, I'm over.
Yeah, no cool. Problem. And with the kids, everyone in the family can enjoy it. So cool.
Oh, they wouldn't let me go on my own.
No. But I thank you. I thank you very much for being on the Going Bananas show. And it's been truly my honor to listen to you and talk with you.
Look, Ian, you did a great job. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.